Hello, welcome to the Tuesday Night Discussion Group. We'll be discussing tonight Steve Ozenich, The Great Pain Deception, chapters 18 and 19. This is going to be pretty good, real good, as a matter of fact. We got a lot of callers in tonight. Somebody's got a ring going there, but I'm sure they'll catch it. But anyway, we got a good bit of people on here tonight. This is going to be TNA. Major Personality Types and Health, Chapter 18, and then we'll be discussing separation and rage at 26 months. It'll be about separation basically, in Chapter 19. This is, again, all these discussions has been very helpful to me and a lot of people that are on the forum and that's on the phones right now. So we just appreciate everybody being here. And before we start, I do need to remind everyone that this is a peer support group. None of us are medical or mental health professionals. Now, with that being said, I know my buddy there's got a summary, and we'll start.
Well, like Herbie said, tonight we're going to be discussing Chapter 18, Major Personality Types and Health, and Chapter 19, Separation and Rage at 26 Months, which goes into Clancy McKenzie's two-stage trauma. But we'll begin with Chapter 18, TNA, Major Personality Types and Health. I don't know what kind of a pun that is. It sounds like it's from a Keith Richards song, but a little TNA. But I try and pick up on some of Steve's puns in here sometimes, and the orthography especially.
I
Like,
still don't know what that means.
yeah, well, Thomas Jefferson, where he says Moss, M, lower A, and S. It must mean something about his TMS personality type. Oh
Okay.
yeah, there's the T, Tom. Yeah, now I see it. Duh. Yeah,
Hey,
it catches up
I
with
didn't
you.
see it. That's pretty good, Bruce.
Yeah, well, chapter 18 begins with a discussion of the different major personality types and the relationship to health. Everyone's pretty much familiar with the type A personality type. In 1960, San Francisco cardiologists Meyer Friedman and Ray Rosenman did a famous study in which they introduced the concepts of the type A and B personalities. Where this relates to TMS, Steve says, is due to a third personality type that he calls the type T or type TE, T prime, that he classifies as a quasi combination of both type A and type B. Type A is characterized as being belligerent, impatient, tempestuous, competitive, hostile. A rage type A treats time as an enemy and ultimately pays what Steve calls a higher price at the pump. That is the heart pump, which Aristotle said was the center of all emotions. So what Steve's saying is they feel in their heart and they overdrive it that way. They appear to be externalizing their rage, but actually they're concentrating their rage in their heart muscle, I guess. They're impatient.
That would be the reason they have more, or common sense thoughts would be the reason they have more heart problems. Is that right? I know the
Well,
type
it's
T has less heart problems, right?
yeah, right. And the type B has the least of all. But
Yeah.
type A is impatient. He's at war with time. Dr. Rosenman indicates that a type A has an unusual preoccupation with time. Rarely late for appointments. He wears out the edge of his chair. He urges to accomplish as much in as short a time as possible, trying to always cram in more, which must make him bear down more. This is the antithesis of the type T personality, or the type A is. On the other hand, the type B is characterized as being reasoned, easygoing, less ambitious, accommodating, cooperative, kickback, sang-froid. He's unflappable even under stress. I've known a lot of guys who've been under tremendous stress who've gotten so used to it that now out in regular life, they're imperturbable. People can be screaming and yelling and so on around them. And they seem to act as calmers in an environment. People use them as a magnetic north to orientate themselves around. That's just my observation, not Steve's. But then there is the type T or TE, typical of a TMS-prone individual. Steve says that the type T is a blend of A and B traits, so be considered what he calls a type AB. This type T is prone to chronic pain, fatigue, digestive tract problems, skin problems, and anything else that might be in vogue as listed in Appendix A of Steve's book. And if you turn to Appendix A, you'll find that there are a large number of TMS equivalent disorders listed and described: acid reflux, acne, carpal tunnel syndrome, allergies, dry spot in the throat, heart flutter, hypertension even. That's described in The Divided Mind. There's a contributor there who shows the link between high blood pressure and TMS in some individuals. Irritable bladder, all of those things that are in Appendix A are typical of afflictions that the type T personality gets. And Steve characterizes the type T as being narcissistic, internalizing, automatic repression of things that don't go perfectly. And that, of course, increases the stress level. They're controlled, uses control, and by default, creativity. They're also creative individuals. And they have an easy outward appearance, but they're smiling through the pain and thereby hides his or her true feelings from themselves and the people around them. This is that sort of self versus the shadow that we covered last time, I think, that division that Jung noted.
I think we should probably jump in. Didn't we? We were going to do a different format this time. Like, I thought that we were going to have the initial introduction, like 1 to 2 minutes. Like, I think we're going over it too much. I think we have to keep it really fast. Let's do like maybe a 30-second wrap up of this chapter, and then we'll hand it off to Herbie, and he can do a question, and we'll kind of bounce it back and forth, because I think it's the bouncing that works.
Yeah. I think you've done good. Let me go ahead and ask a question. If you don't want to, do you want to do the 30-second wrap up? Bruce, you want me to ask a question?
Well, the next sections of the chapter cover the tyranny of shoulds, which is kind of a perpetual motion machine, an argument in the subconscious between the should and don't give a damn. And then the rest of the chapter goes over the introverted, intuitive, feeling, perceiving type of personality that Steve feels is the closest match to a TMSer, a hard-driven perfectionist. And then he talks about Thomas Jefferson and how he had to walk all the time perfectly in a rigid way, and what a perfectionist he was, and how his demeanor reflected his perfectionism. And we're at chapter 19 now.
We're up to separation, we'll get to that. That's next, right?
Yeah, separation
anxiety. Separation's next. Okay, let me go ahead and ask a question that's from Steve's excerpt from the top T's you was just talking about, which is a combination of the A and B.
Yeah.
This will be from page 229. It says, top T is a blend of top A and B personalities. The top T is prone to chronic pain, fatigue, digestive tract problems, skin problems, and anything else that may be in vogue. See Appendix A. The type T has been told that showing anger is a bad thing, as is complaining. He has never learned to express anger and appropriately. He suffers from terminal niceness. Now my question, really we're going to start with Bruce and then we're going to go around, is how do we show our anger appropriately? And the way I would answer that is if somebody asked me, I'd say, you know, with meditations and mindfulness, and I'm going to stop there. And see what anybody in a good way that we can, you know, express our anger in other forms. Because when I first started learning this, guys, and I was reading that I needed to express my anger, I thought that I was supposed to be more angry at the people that did me wrong. And I was shooting up the wrong tree there, because I got in a lot of trouble and a lot of arguments, which only caused me more pain. So I think it's important that we know how to express our anger. And basically, like I said, one of the ways I do it is through meditations and mindfulness, getting relaxed and calm. But Bruce, you got anything to add to that?
Well, I think the problem is not letting your anger boil over, because you're not repressing it. So you don't get those periodic spikes where it dissipates itself. If you're in touch with your feelings, including anger, you don't have to repress those feelings and let them boil over or explode. So being in touch with them and not repressing them means that you can express when you're mad, you're mad. You're not holding it back and then letting it burst out.
I like that. That's very good. Forrest, you want to elaborate on that?
I don't know if I have much to say, but but that's not going to stop me.
I know it.
You probably saw me in the thing. Yeah, I mean, I hear it on this one. Like, how does one know? Like, sometimes I think, I don't know, I guess this comes down to mindfulness, maybe, where you need to know what's going on without... I mean, I think some people vent it, but I think sometimes venting isn't the right thing to do. I'm a big fan of Daniel Goleman and his emotional intelligence, where I think it's, he says that emotional intelligence is knowing what you're feeling and knowing how, what to do with that. And I guess maybe that's a long way of saying that maybe it varies case to case.
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
Anybody else got anything?
Well, I'm just agreeing with what Forrest is saying, because I know, you know, from my ridiculously old age of 68, what I've learned is that sometimes I throw a giant shit fit, and I try and do that by myself, but still makes me feel better. And other times I attack it rationally, and other times I just let it go. And, you know, I mean, it just depends.
Wow, that's good.
But it's you know, it's a matter of being in a rational mode and deciding what the right thing is to do, but not repressing it forever. No, that's not the right thing to do.
That's awesome. Yeah.
I have a bit of a personal experience. So, I mean, I think so much of what we deal with has to go down to our parents. And I have an issue with my father. I felt like I had TMS for about 18 years, and I felt like he didn't support me during that time. And so I'm kind of angry at him, and I don't know, like the anger just kind of, it's there. And I'd like to say I'd like to forgive him, but you know, there's those deeper parts of my brain that don't forgive. And recently it came out, and I said, I'm going to be emotional. I'm going to let him know. And we had a gigantic blow up in January of this year. And then we said we were going to try and process it. My stepmother is a psychotherapist, so we have to process everything. I don't know. I kind of feel like to some degree, one of the things I learned is I learned about people have limits and they can only do so much. And you can't make a big blow up out of everything, because sometimes it just makes things worse. So I think that was a big lesson for me that I've been learning. Maybe it's relevant. I can't go all type A. Like, it's gonna make it worse. Can anyone else relate to that?
Jay, you want to say anything about that?
No, I'm okay. I'm trying to figure out. I know you guys are on this forum talking to each other.
Uh-huh.
Are you not? I don't know how to do this. I wish I did.
we're on the meeting. And after the show, Bruce, can we help him with that? I mean, Forrest, We'll talk to you about it after.
You know,
the
I
song,
tell you yeah. what, there's a program I've been wanting to start. Every Thursday, I'd like to give people tours of this. It's a big site, and there's about a million things to do. I will send him an email after the show, and I'll set up a special tour for you. If anyone else want to be on that tour, where I can tell
site?
Everything, whatever. Well, basically, whatever people want, we'll get on this phone line, and so we'll be able to talk. And then I'll give you a website that you can go to where you can watch my screen, and I'll just show you stuff.
I'd like to do that for us. What time are you thinking?
Well, let's set it up afterwards, but I'll put your name on it because I don't want to hijack the show, and I'll put both of you. Anyone else?
Yeah, put me on there too, Forrest.
Yeah, man, send it to me, man.
Okay. Who's that third voice? I'm not very good with voices. Was that
Northstar?
Is that Montana Mom? No, Northstar, yeah. Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah, the name change.
yeah, of course.
Great.
Back to you, Herbie.
Okay.
Sorry. If I can jump in and one last thing, Jay, you're not missing anything going on right now. All the talk is going on the phone line, so you're not missing anything.
Okay, man. All right. Thanks.
Okay. Steve's got another excerpt from the book. He says, tease or do-gooders. The top tease bury the potential to proclaim self. My question would be, so we need to go and do the things in life we love to do more. That's self-proclaiming is the way, you know, I see what he's saying there, but we bury that part, you know? And Bruce, you got anything to add to that?
I think if we're doing things without repressing our emotions, we don't have to self-proclaim. Who we are is obvious. It's written all over the image we project. It's a matter of being honest with yourself and with others, I'd say. I guess it's like the difference between teaching by your example and loudly declaiming precepts in order to try and manipulate people and reality when you can't.
To me, it's like, you know, we got the shadow part, we got the part that we bury, we got the ego part, we got the part that we hide from everybody, and then we got the part that everybody sees, our personality. And you know, there's a part in there that really wants to get out, that really wants to express itself, and we tend to bury it and keep it in there, keep it held down, you know? Forrest, do you want to elaborate on that?
I can say
the excerpt again. Let me say the excerpt again. It's tease or do-gooders. The top tease bury the potential to proclaim self.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think that's, I would agree with that. It feels like when people go through, say, our structured educational program, it feels like a lot of what we're doing is we're just coming into touch with getting more into touch with feel. I guess to go back to my example, with my father and the frustration that I feel with him, we don't see eye to eye on it. We have different explanations. And so I can't talk to him about it, but at least I know it's there. You know, like I can talk about it now. I can talk about it with my girlfriend. I can talk about it with you guys. I can get support. I can journal about it. Dr. Hanscom talks about it's important to write something down and then you throw it away. So I can use my emotional intelligence on it. Whereas if I'm not even aware of it, that's where the real tragedy happens.
Okay, great.
Did I get that right? Because I'm not sure if I get the quote.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did. You did. Okay. Well, the quote's basically, you know, this is good. This goes to everybody listening right now. What is it? Basically, are you burying something that you? Do you feel like, as you've learned, as you went through the TMS Wiki, as some has done the SCP? And some have read, you know, Dr. Sarno's books and everything else. And as you learn, do you feel like you need to get up and self-proclaim, do more things to enjoy life, do more things to let the inside part, that person on the inside that's always wanted to do a lot of things in life, that's procrastinated, that's set back. Do you feel like, you know, you've got that part that you can step out and start doing things and enjoying life more, and then it will, what it will do is it will lessen the pain in your body. It will help lessen the rage. Do y'all get that question?
Okay. I think I do. Yeah, no, I'm working on it. I mean, for me, my big passion is, as you might have guessed, starting a nonprofit.
I know that. You're the man. You are. You're the man, and we're all proud of you, Forrest.
I do it because I love it too. You know, and I think TMS wanted to take away my ability. I always kind of wanted to start a business when I was younger. You know, something. I love building stuff, and TMS took that away from me. And so, I'll be the first one to say I work crazy hours on all of this, but it gives me so much back. I wake up happy and ready to go, and I'm still going through a process and figuring out what I love to do. But I feel a lot more confident doing that than I would otherwise. I mean, I know spending so much time on this, that'll affect how much income I make. But I think one of the things I've learned is that you, through all these TMS explorations, is that you have to do what you love. Different for everyone, of course.
That is a great answer. Anybody else want to elaborate on what Forrest just said?
Well, I would just like to say TMS took, I had illusions of putting my own business in years ago, and TMS took that away from me too, as well, Forrest.
Yeah.
I can appreciate what you're saying. I mean, it just took it straight away.
Yeah.
I was in the process of doing it, and it just took me down to the point where I had to stop.
I still have the medical record from someone who said, wrote, you know, my physiatrist wrote on it, you probably can't be a programmer. You know, it's just unlikely, probably not prudent to ever be a programmer. And I said, oh, okay, now I got to find something else to do with my life. That hurt. I taught a guy to program. He went on to Amazon and worked at Amazon when it was starting up, cashed out his options and made $600,000. I taught him how to program.
Wow. Well, that's a blessing. It'll come back to you.
It was the .com era.
That's awesome.
Someday.
Basically, does anybody get what I'm getting to is, does anybody want to say, you know, the good story part now, the part that you stepped out, you done something and it changed, and it gave you back, you know, your joy. And when it done that, you noticed the difference. You finally started doing something you might have wanted to do, and it gave you back your hope. It gave you, and yet it actually lessened the pain in your body. Does anybody want to elaborate on that?
Yeah, I just had that happen. This is Jay.
Okay.
I just had that happen, and not on such a positive note. I regret to report to you folks that I made a financial deal the last month or so, and it did not turn out too well for me. I had been down with TMS. I'd been suffering in a lot of panic, a lot of fear, and I had no business making any kind of major financial business deals, whatever. However, I did not know I was that mentally screwed up, and so I did so anyway. And I came out pretty far behind. It wasn't horrible, but it was far from good. And it gave me a lot of grief when I looked back and saw how I had screwed up some simple stuff, because I was panicked and scared and shouldn't have been dealing. When I look back and saw that, I just got in a lot of grief and a lot of regret. And after about a week of that, I noticed that my back's just getting a whole lot better.
Man, so you basically went through it, experienced it, instead of holding it in.
And the last 2 or 3 weeks, and I mean, I've been suffering with, I know it's TMS, I've been suffering with this stuff since July.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden that happened, and within 3 weeks now, it's like 75% better than it was.
All right.
I'll be focused on to something else, something else bad. So my TMSing moved from the back to the bad financial deal and had something to occupy it, so the back started getting a lot better.
All right. It a good thing turned into something better, right?
I thought I had to pay. I had to pay to get this betterment. I will take it. That will be. I would gladly pay as much as I lost to get this. I really would.
Nice. So
yeah.
That's what just happened to me.
Great.
All right.
Hey, this is
Philly
this
Joe.
Is
Philly Joe.
This is Philly Joe.
Hey, Philly Joe.
Philly Joe calling from Michigan.
All right.
You know,
I wish
I could say I had this great success story, but in a sense, it's been. I think I'm working towards that. You know, with this ringing in my ear, but it occurred a little over a month ago at a time, and Herbie, I spoke with Herbie kind of individually online, working through this personal addiction problem that I have, and through my faith and through doing some work, I've really gotten a nice handle on it, which has actually helped my anger issues, because when you got addiction of anything, you've got anger. You can understand that. But yet this ringing in the ear thing came up, and what it's actually been doing, what I'm trying to do, many of you have given me wonderful support and great knowledge, but it's rekindled in me my own personal spirit, my own personal faith, and connecting the mind-body symptoms and TMS. And what I'm really hoping for is somewhere down the line when this ringing stops, there really is going to be a new transformation of my mind. And that's what I'm really excited about. Not there yet.
Awesome.
I mean, it could come tonight. It may not come for a year, you know. I mean, but I am doing the work. It is frustrating because this is a new symptom that I just, hasn't gone away. So still kind of struggling, really struggling, thinking psychologically versus the physical. But I hope one day to say, man, this is a real breakthrough. Hope that made sense.
I think it did, and I think you made a good breakthrough by getting on here and speaking it like that. You know, that was great,
yeah.
Philly.
Yeah, let me. It's just to tell you guys. I think I may have said this one of the first times that I called. I do addiction work at the hospital I work at, and the research. And I know everybody likes doing research, but the research has clearly shown that support groups, any kind of support group, this support group, AA, NA, whatever, you know, Schizophrenics Anonymous, people who are in support groups have so much better chances of staying in recovery and not relapsing. I just really dig this support group because it's helping me at least not relapse further. You know, at least I'm at baseline TMS.
That's awesome, man.
Yes, yes, I agree. I understand.
That's good.
That is good, Philly Joe. Anybody else want to elaborate? Okay, I'm going to go to the next question. Well, Forrest? I saw you move.
Well, I just can't. And you did because you're a good facilitator. And I just wanted to say that if we've got a good support group, man, oh man, that comes down a lot to your good facilitation. But anyway, I'll let you go on. But I just
he
had to send you some
volumes. Love. Yeah, Philly Joe spoke volumes there. Thank you, Philly Joe. Thank you, Jay. Okay. Well, I'll go to the next question. I'm going to read Steve's excerpt. It's from his book, the type A is more, he says the type A is more hostile than the type T. Type T feels the need to be more gentle, accommodating, and helpful. My question is, these are good attributes that can get us into trouble at times, although they're very powerful attributes to have. And Bruce, you got anything to elaborate on that?
Well, I want to see what's self-defeating about these goodest traits. And I think it's being too dang good, as we noticed last time, causes us to create a shadow self that embodies a lot of nasty, downright evil traits that will out, too, I think. They want to rise to the surface. I guess it's like where people use goodism as a club to make themselves feel better than other people, to really look down on them while polishing a false front. I think Molière, the 17th century French playwright, has a play entitled Tartuffe about a religious bigot who's always doing that. And I think it's like it's a satire on that, or it's an ironic comedy showing how he makes all these social guffaws. It seems to me that in this question, in this need for goodest traits, it's also another attempt to make up for feeling downright low about yourself. You don't have to go around being good all the time unless you're trying to compensate. And I guess it feeds on itself, doesn't it, Forrest? The more you repress into the dark region of your unconscious these bad traits, and the more you polish this false persona, the greater the gap becomes between the two, until you've got tension. You've got this id superego coming into being, this conflict, which Dr. Sarno says is the driving force behind the T in TMS, behind the tension. So,
awesome.
Yeah, thanks for asking that, Herbie.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. Forrest, do you want to elaborate on how the goodest attributes can get us in trouble and cause rage?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that Bruce made an excellent point about how the tension can kind of spiral upwards as you're trying to reach these ideals. I think authentic acceptance is huge. It reminds me a lot of going back when we were reading that book, Pathways to Pain Relief, by Sherman and Anderson, those two Sarno psychologists. And then they were talking about where the TMS traits come from in childhood. And you know, why do we have to be so perfectionist? Well, maybe we feel bad about something and we're trying to fix something. It kind of ties into the other chapter that we did, which is abandonment. And you know, maybe the way we have to be perfect, because if we aren't perfect, then we might be abandoned.
Wow, that's awesome. We got to write that down. Yes, please do.
Chime in here. Yeah, I was just thinking about how codependency kind of plays into this too. I mean, some of my earliest memories were volunteering when I was real little. My mom would haul us off to a soup kitchen, so I kind of grew up with the volunteer. You know, my mom was very volunteer oriented, in spite of basically being a single mom of seven kids, alcoholic husband, yada yada. And as I grew up, I've always been others-minded, but I had to work through some real anger. I spent several years as a young adult just volunteering. And I look back at, I had some real anger that I had to address, because I realized my volunteerism wasn't just because I was such a wonderful, benevolent person. I mean, there were good intentions in there, sure. But the emotional feedback I was getting, the kudos I was getting, was really important to me. And I had looked back and realized, wow, that was really codependent. And then having to work through the anger of that season of my life of feeling like I had been taken advantage of, which there was, because you get that whole dynamic going with, you know, one who's codependent and the, you know, just all those complicated interactions that that are in play there. So I know for me, that was part of my mechanism, was just out of deriving my self-worth from the kudos and the approval for other based upon what I could do for them. Does that make sense?
Yes, yeah. It does.
Could you tell us a little bit about a definition of codependence? Because I've heard the term a million times, but I don't have a good definition in my mind.
Well, my definition is the need to be needed. You know, I'm taking better care of you than you are. Children, adult children of alcoholics do that beautifully. And it's pretty self-defeating, but it's also that need to take care of somebody who's not taking care of themselves. You get this sick self-worth out of it. It's not a healthy self-worth.
Right.
It's just a sick interplay between the two people. And realizing that is a huge, you know, you're going to find some relationships just fall by the wayside when you're not playing that role anymore. And it can disguise itself. I mean, the easy setting is to think of, well, the, you know, the wife married to the alcoholic husband. But right. That can really play out. And I've seen it play out in churches. I've seen it play out in the workplace. Where somebody is just going above and beyond, and there's some emotional needs there that are being met that aren't real healthy.
Yes, codependency has a lot to do with control issues.
Oh yeah,
because the person who is not addicted is making every effort to control the person who is addicted.
Absolutely.
And then, really, what happens when the person who is addicted is in recovery and tries to gain control back in their life, oh boy, that codependent person, now you're stepping into their territory.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and if their whole worth is wrapped up in that, it is devastating.
And very, very good. Yes, if their self-worth, because now who are they going to take care of?
Yeah.
And what they really need to do is begin to, what they really need to do, like all of us, is to begin to take care of ourselves first and not try to control others.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems like that's been one of my problems. I'm learning this with an older daughter. My type A anger personality of trying to control an adult daughter who's made a lot of bad mistakes, and really learning now, I have to let her make those mistakes, even though it has serious consequences to her. But as a parent, and maybe a codependent parent, you don't want to see someone else fail.
Mm-hmm.
Does that help you, Forrest?
it sure does. I loved that definition.
Yes, that's awesome.
And it seems like something that we would have, that we might see a bunch on the forum, because on a forum, you know, it is a wonderful place to help each other, but at the same time, you have to maintain those boundaries.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good stuff. Good, wow. Something to think about.
Anybody else elaborate on that? Okay, I'm going to go to the next question, Bruce. I'm going to go to page 3. Okay. I'm going to go to page 3. It's a quote from, or it's Steve's excerpt. We can change. He says we can change much about our physical destinies. That is a fact. It's been proven by Dr. Sarno's studies and by the results of guided imagery and learned relaxation. And my question, Bruce, is do you do guided imagery? And if so, can you explain it for the listeners to know?
I don't know very much about it myself, but I know that they use it in sports, like in gymnastics, where if you try to do an elaborate routine, a dismount off of a pair of rings, just doing it intellectually and learning about it isn't enough. You have to have a kind of spatiotemporal image of doing this that you rehearse again and again in your brain. And there's a lot of what I would call body-mind coaching in gymnastics. And also in ballet, for that matter, I can think of that too. Where you can't just do a particular point move without visualizing it first. I guess it's like that old Buddhist aphorism, you can't do anything you can't imagine first. So trying to do it without the imagination preceding it. So that's what I think a visualization is like.
I like your example about when you go rock climbing. Can you give that example?
Well, it's like you sit down at the base of a boulder problem that's maybe 10 feet high with a lot of little holds on it, and you look at it and you create a visual diagram in your mind of your the points that you'll be using with your of attachment with your body, with your feet and with your hands. And you see the sequence of moves and visually have a visual, an almost graphic appreciation of it in your mind, so that when you go to execute, you just repeat the image that you've already constructed. I think that holds true for lots of sports where you have to do things on a intuitive level, where you've learned it at a deeper level than just the cerebral cortex or the prefrontal cortex. It isn't just an intellectual thing. It's a connection between your mind and your body.
Yeah, Steve talks about he visualized his, you know, his spine is being just super perfect. He saw it. Mm-hmm. We read about it earlier in the book. And I do a lot of visualizations to where I just see myself, you know, this person that's just all powerful, man. I see it. I'm not far from being what I've been seeing for the last year and a half while I've been doing imagery. I didn't much do imagery in the past, but it has really helped me a lot in the last year and a half. Does anybody else, Tom, you on here, buddy?
Yeah, I just woke up. Sorry. I did the reading and then promptly fell asleep.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, do you want to elaborate anything on imagery or you know, before you go play a tennis game? Maybe you might see it in your mind that, you know, what you're going to do and how you're going to beat all the younger guys out there or anything?
Yeah, I agree with Bruce. If you can't imagine it, you can't do it. You have to imagine it first. And I agree with that. Yeah, today I was I did a little practice. It was really cold out here, and it was just real cold. So I called into a nice warm bed and read my Steve-O, and I did visualize some elements. I was practicing my serve, and afterwards I wrote some notes about the new elements that I discovered during the practice. So that next time I practice, I'll start at that point rather than doing the same thing over and over again.
Do you think it has to be a visual image, a thing that's spatiotemporal in your imagery in your brain before you do it? Like a little visual diagram that you hold inside of your brain and connect to your central nervous system. You know, is that kind of what you do?
I put it into words, let's say a tennis serve, you know, something basic. It might have, let's say, 100 elements to it, kinesthetic elements to it.
Yeah.
And every time I make a breakthrough, discovering a new body part, for instance, just objectively speaking, I discovered that I needed to straighten my arm out at the elbow more on the take back to get a greater range of motion. And I took a couple of notes about it so I don't forget. And then next time I got them practiced, I'll review the notes and start with the words and then see in my mind the body parts involved.
Awesome. So basically, everybody, sum it up. It's a good thing if you want to, you know, get better. It's a good thing to go ahead and see it in your mind that you are better. See yourself up, walking around, doing the things you've always wanted to do. Practice these visualizations. Find out imagery on the internet, ways to do it, and practice it. Is there anybody else that would want to comment on maybe imagery that you might do?
You know, I'll chime in here. I love this picture that my friend gave me. She went on a white water rafting. Is really big out here. And my friend said the first thing when she went on a white river rafting tour was the tour guide told him, if you get thrown overboard, put your feet down river and relax. You'll end up on the other side of the river. So I love that visualization for distress management, trying to you know, when I'm having a getting uptight, that's what I like to picture. And it really is pretty amazing how I think that just works practically.
That's awesome.
But it's a wonderful visualization to just go with the flow.
That's awesome. And everybody does know that we also can visualize in our minds, you know, bad things and worries and doubts and pain brings a lot of that on. And one of the things we need to do is start visualizing ourselves, you know, with ourselves up, doing what we wanted to do, doing what we've always wanted to do, and get that straightened out. Quit focusing on the, you know, or quit seeing that picture as a bad picture and make it a good picture. In other words, your mind, you got the power to do it, right?
I think that makes a lot of sense. I like that a lot. I mean, because one thing I've been thinking about a lot is that old Cherokee story. Have you guys heard that Cherokee story? I've been thinking about it a lot recently.
The wolf? The wolf?
Yeah, the two wolves. I know you've heard it because I'm sure we've talked about it.
Yeah.
Have other people heard this?
Yeah, I'm from Rome, so we know it here in Rome.
Never heard it.
Yeah. All right,
I haven't heard it, Jim.
So this is an old Cherokee story about a grandfather and a grandson. And the grandfather says, you know, inside every human being, there are two wolves. And one wolf is the wolf, and they're locked in mortal combat. And one wolf is the wolf of avarice, of greed, of cruelty. And the other one is the wolf of kindness and compassion and love. And the grandson turns to him and says, "Oh, Grandpa, which one of these two wins? You know, what is our basic fundamental human nature?" And the grandfather says, "The one that I feed." And I just love that image that you know, that I mean, when I think about the law of attraction. And how that a lot of people like that, and it doesn't speak to me. I'll confess, but I know it speaks to a lot of people, and so I have to respect that. And I think, you know, maybe it does, because if you take the time to visualize something positive and believe that something positive is going to happen, then that's where your attention is going, and you know that's the wolf that you're feeding. You're teaching your mind how to prepare for that positive thing. And it just feels like, you know, pain is distraction. It grabs our attention and makes us think about all these negative things. But if we take some time to visualize health, it seems like that's feeding the wolf of health. Like that's a much more positive thing.
Very good.
Absolutely.
Anybody want to elaborate on that? That's pretty good. Pretty good. Okay, I'm going to go to the next question. Okay?
Sounds good.
Steve's excerpt is, "You don't need to change your personality to heal, as Dr. Sarno has stated, but sometimes your life needs to be dissected and specific memories discharged to heal." Now, what I'd say is this is my question to everybody, basically. Is this not when we have to look deeper and do our work in the past and also in the now? And Bruce, you want to elaborate on that first, and then we're going to go around.
Seems like some people do have to go deeper to dissipate their repressed emotions, the emotions that are leading to inner rage. Sometimes just understanding how TMS works is enough to do the trick. That's for sometimes for quite a few people. Maybe it's got to do with how successful a repressor you are and how long you've been doing it. I know that I started on the road to healing when I used one of Howard Schubner's ISTDP exercises to go back and feel how angry I was when my father started strangling me in the garage for going surfing. I felt like a complete martyr too. Because I was taking 19 units in junior college, getting straight A's, working a job, running on the track team, being a first-class good boy. So that made it hurt all the more and made it stand out. But I think what happened, I was thinking about this later after I answered this question, Eric's question, was that when you repress those kinds of nuggets of rage and they don't have any access, then via the unconscious processes, you express them all over the place. And even it creates even a bigger debt on your part to dissipate with TMS pain in order to blot it out. Whereas if you've gone back to those memories and dissipated the rage and made them conscious, then they're not buried in your unconscious anymore. They don't function to create tension in quite the same way after you've been there and let them go. They lose their power over you.
That's awesome, man. Anybody want to elaborate on what Bruce just said? That's pretty awesome. Basically, the question was, you don't need to change your personality to heal, as Dr. Sarnoff has stated, but sometimes your life needs to be dissected and specific memories discharged to heal. As we talk a lot about on TMS Wiki, as the program, we go through it, and we, you know, have to stop repressing and get it out. But still, that don't mean we have to change, you know, who we are, right?
Eric, isn't that a big question in TMS recovery and TMS therapies, whether you actually have to go deep or whether you should keep it all on the surface? It seems that we've answered the question that going deep sometimes is efficacious, is an efficient approach.
Yes, sometimes it is. To other people, it's counterproductive. You know, some people, it just, I think Steve sort of stayed in the now and just watched his reaction control and stuff. But at the same time, you know, he went through so much. He had to dissect too, you know, with his wife and everything he went through. We can go through so much that we have to journal. We have to, you know, speak to somebody about it. We've got to be able to not repress and talk about these things. And wow, I could go on. Does anybody want to elaborate on this?
I'd like to say something. I must say that you know, maybe I'm misunderstanding what they're saying, but I think all this jazz about how you don't have to go deep is a bunch of baloney. I really do. you know, you don't have to spend the rest of picking the lint out of your navel. I mean, you know, you've got to live your life and so on. But who was it that said that the unexamined life is not worth living? I absolutely.
I think that was Thoreau, wasn't it?
Yeah. If you don't spend some time examining what you believe and why you believe it and who you really are and what it all means, you're a cabbage. You're not a person. And, you know, and just because you're a cabbage with no TMS is not, in my opinion, a good thing. You know, I guess that's why I really love the people, the TMS people who, you know, take a look at yourself, see what needs to be changed. I don't personally believe for one second that you can change your basic personality. That's who you are, right? That's who you are. But you can sure as heck take a good look at all the things that you might be doing that are not in line with who you really are. And bringing that all together into a mature, intelligent, thought-out package. So if that's going deep, then I'm for going deep.
Yes, dissecting, that's good. Basically, you know, what I've done that really helped me a lot, I did what you call timeline therapy, and I went back, I saw me at 4 years old, and he was scared. He was a scared little person, and I reached over and hugged him. I gave him a hug, and we grew up together, and I flew back into the now, and I know this sounds wild, but at the same time, it made me feel completely different.
Yeah.
In other words, it took a lot of hurt on the inside from years ago, and it made me feel complete, which lessened a lot of pain I had at the time. So I did do a lot of dissecting. Anybody else want to elaborate on
you
maybe
need
what
to,
you do?
And I think as you get older, it becomes more and more profound. You know, I mean, what you're going to dissect when you're 20 years old, when you're, you know, you're all strength and hormones, is not going to be the same thing as what you dissect when you're 40 or when you're 60. We change. But we do have to spend some time with ourselves, or we're not going to know ourselves. And if we don't know ourselves, we're not going to lead the life that, you know, that really we should lead. And you know, I mean, of course, with TMS, if knowing that it's just TMS and then the pain goes away and then it never comes back, and if that works for you, that's great. You know, you could maybe go on not, you know, being type A or you know, a driven person with all your goals and stuff until that doesn't work anymore, right? But when it doesn't work, it's time to, I think it's time to get busy and look at who you really are. But not from the point of view of changing your personality. No, we are what we are in every, I mean, I love that Myers-Briggs thing. You are every, there's all those 16 different personality types, and they're all great. We need those people. We need them. We don't want to change that about ourselves. But, you know, we do have to set things out and decide what we're living for and why we're living for it and that sort of thing, or else I just don't think it works otherwise.
Well, I think sometimes... Oh, go on. I was just going to say, sometimes I think we want to go deep, and now I'm not a navel gazer myself. I just am too impatient. I know you've got to do some of the work. I think sometimes it's just as simple as being honest with yourself and being accepting of who you are. And I think that's a really, that's a huge thing. I mean, you can go deep all you want, but until you're willing to look in the mirror and say, you know, I'm happy with who I am. I accept myself as I am.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the process. That's sure. Yeah.
So interesting to hear how these things resonate. Like as Herbie was talking about timeline therapy, how he used that reminded me a lot of Parts. And we've got the acceptance theme that also kind of reminds me of the Parts therapy approach. It's nice to see all these ideas together. The quote, which I thought was very interesting. So today during the show, I've tried to jump in and kind of enforce the idea of people dialogue and you know, different people bouncing from one person to the next. I guess that's kind of my role in the community, is to try and look and how do we foster the best discussion. And I look on the forum, and one thing I want to focus on the forum is I love some feistiness. Let's know that it's okay for different people to have different opinions. And so I love an Enjoy coming in here and sharing her opinion. She makes me smile the way she shares it. I'm going to jump in and say a slightly different opinion, a little bit closer to Steve. So Steve here, he says, as Darno has shown, you don't have to change your personality to heal. The understanding of the TMS process and full belief are all that is normally needed to heal, but not always. Sometimes your life needs to be dissected and specific memories discharged to heal. That pretty much captures my personal feelings, just my position. But in that, if we go back to that Thoreau quote, the unexamined life is not worth living. I mean, Thoreau was a writer. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't a mind-body coach. And to some degree, I think that what he's making there is he's talking almost as an artist. He's making... he's saying about what life he wants to live and what he thinks the good life is. It's almost an aesthetic judgment. And so I would agree with what Enjoy is saying on aesthetic grounds, saying, you know, the good life, the way that I want to live my life is I want to know what's going on. I'll do this deep work for myself because it's valuable, because the TMS has been a signal to me that there's good work to be done and that I can live a better life if I do this work. But from a pain perspective, in terms of people getting better, when I look at the big recoveries that I've seen, the methods which I think work the best are accepting the diagnosis, that knowledge therapy, and then looking at where your tension comes from on a day-to-day basis. And sometimes accepting is, as Montana Mom was mentioning, accepting helps you diminish that tension. But just trying to figure out where the tension comes from. One of my favorite exercises is you take a big blank sheet of paper, you put your name in the center, or just draw a little stick person in the center, that's you, and you say, where is my energy going? On a day-to-day basis, where is my energy going? And then you look at each of those things and you say, well, you know, where are my sources of tension in here? Where are my sources of stress? And how do I soothe those things? Anyway, so that's did you want to follow up on that, Enjoy?
No, that makes
sense to you?
Me, I mean, as long as it works. But if it doesn't work, then you have to move past that. Because I really believe that, you know, just what I said is that you're not going to do this probably when you're 20, right?
Yeah.
But as you get older, you might need to examine. And it's not just aesthetics. I mean, it may have been for Thoreau, but for me, it's not just aesthetics. It's really understanding who I am and what I want to give the world, that kind of thing. I mean, I'm an INFJ, and we're a sort of a rare bird, so maybe it's just me. But yeah, of course, you know, I'm totally practical. I mean, if it works, it works, and you're not going to stop your career or dump your family or you know, not spend time with your kids because you're busy journaling or whatever. But yeah, you know, somewhere along there, I think that most people probably would benefit from spending a little time with themselves and understanding who they are. That's all.
Oh, nice. Anyone else want to weigh in on that? In your own experience, like, do you find that, what do you think the solution is for you? Because I think it is so personal. Different things work for different people.
At different stages of their lives.
Yep.
I mean, I'm 68, for heaven's sake, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm not going to try and feed this to somebody younger because, you know, maybe they're not there. They're busy, for Pete's sake. They just need the pain to stop.
Well, I just like to say, I would like to say that I've found through the years that some of the worst company that I could have is myself, just being alone by myself.
Yeah.
The longer I stay by myself, the crazier I seem to get. My mind, my brain, and my mind circles and jumps and moves, and I just get screwy. If I'm talking to someone, I'm ventilating, if I have some problems or not, just as long as I'm sitting here listening to you guys, just straightens my mind out. Whereas if I just sit here by myself tonight, I'll turn into a ball of worms and get all crooked and screwy and so forth. And this old saying says the worst company that I can have is my own. Alone.
Yeah.
Well, wow. You know. Now, I do like some time alone. I think everybody does. If I'm around a bunch of people, I don't like to be around a whole crowd of people a lot. Just one or two or three, or maybe three or four, you know, and just so much of that, and then I want my space and my alone time again. But after a certain point of that, I start getting really crazy just being by myself. And if I'm alone too much, then I got to get out, get in my vehicle, drive somewhere, find somebody to talk to, or something. So, there's something Forrest mentioned way earlier in the meeting about, and I depicted it as people pleasing, I kind of forgot what I was going to say, but we do a lot of people pleasing to keep people from abandoning us,
mm-hmm.
from abandoning
yep.
us. I forgot exactly what he was saying, but that was the gist.
That's exactly what I said, yeah. And yeah. Going back to pathways to pain relief, yeah.
Yeah, I can relate very much to that because I'm guilty of doing that a lot.
You said it great,
good,
though, Jay, because...
The goodism, that's what it was about, the good, being good, the goodism and all. And that's all part of people-pleasing. And it just to keep people from leaving us, abandoning us. So...
That's it. The next... Go ahead, Forrest.
Well, and I was just going to say, and sometimes that that type T behavior can come from a position of anxiety where we're afraid of being abandoned or something that might lead to abandonment.
Yeah, that goes right into the next chapter, guys, is separation and rage. You know, I couldn't tell you how many times when I was younger, even now, but when I was younger that, you know, mom would leave or anything and I'd be stuck at the house, I'd be mad. That's just an example, you know. That's not like if somebody passed away, the separation, but it could be, man, we could talk about separation and rage about probably a million different ideas with it, you know, a million different style ways that it can happen. And you know, like Dr. Sarno says, we got three minds. We got the superego, the id, and the ego. And in the very next chapter on separation and rage, Jay, he talks about everyone has an inner child. I think this is Steve saying this. Everyone has an inner child that will never mature. No, that's Dr. McKenzie. I'm sorry. She said everyone has an inner child that will never mature. And it's not even, to me, it's not even about the inner child. I believe Joy would agree with me on this, that, you know, child gets hurt if somebody's that we depend on is not there. And then, you know, we get, what do you call it, depressed. We get worryful. When will they be back? I remember, you know, the puppy love and my first girlfriend that broke up with me and it killed me. You know, and I thought to myself, yeah. What's going on here? What did this girl do to me? You know, what did she do? It was separation rage. I was sitting there at a young age, 17 years old, and to me, I thought my life was over. You know, but that's just an example, and I'd like for other people to bring up examples of this separation rage. Go ahead.
Yeah, everybody has the same thing, I think.
Okay.
But in light of what you're saying about the degree of profundity, of depth, of the of your separation anxiety, Clancy McKenzie says in Steve's book that 99% of the trauma he identified, that McKenzie identifies, has one common denominator: physical or emotional separation from the mother, as experienced by infant. So that first breakup, when the first girl shuts you down, it resonates with that separation when you were a little kid from your mother.
And so that's why it hurt me so bad, right?
I didn't know that at the time, though.
I always wondered, Jay. I always wondered.
Yeah, I didn't understand those dynamics then.
Yeah, but let me, can I, I'd like to throw something,
yeah, please, Joe. Go ahead.
Something to the wind. The whole idea of separation and then anxiety or anger, but yet by the time we get 14, 15, 16, 17, we can't wait to be away from our parents, right? Isn't that kind of a natural evolution of ourselves where the child or breaks away from the nest? Then
but
why?
It's both, though, isn't
so,
it?
So I'm
like
just,
we need
so I'm
them.
Just, but internally we need them. Yes.
Yeah, it tries to bond with a new mother, the new girlfriend, as he breaks away.
Don't tell the girlfriend
the rejection.
Herbie's not being honest in how many hearts he broke. How many ladies out there have separation anxiety because of Herbie?
I can't speak about that. That's terrible. That's terrible, Philly Joe. Puppy love is all we can say about that, right?
That's right.
there are the two forces. You know, we want to be together, but we also want to be individuals.
And be independent, yes.
It's all through life. I mean, it happens in babies, you know. It happens, I mean, two-year-olds, oh my gosh, you know. That's probably the epitome of it, like Steve is saying, at 26 months, we're angry if they're not there, and we're angry if they're in our face telling us what to do, you know?
What to do, yes.
Life is two, it's balancing those two that makes for a life. And you know, I think that Jay was talking about that too, saying that you can only spend so much time by yourself. You start, you know, twisting up into a ball of worms, and you got to get out and drive to the mall and find somebody to talk to. You know, it's just no matter who you are, we have these two. We have to balance those two things.
Hey, if this is off topic, someone please tell me, and don't take it any further. But the whole point of trauma in childhood and looking back at that, I did not experience a lot of trauma. I had a pretty good childhood, and parents were together and very loving and caring. Is that something we could talk, maybe talk about at another time, or does that relate to right now? Because I think someone posted just this week, I think, it was a new member talking about how a lot of TMS things, and when they look back in their childhood and try to dig up stuff, couldn't dig anything up. So they were kind of trying to figure out the TMS diagnosis within themselves.
But isn't it in the nature of life itself? We were discussing at the start, I think maybe off the mic, this separation anxiety and rage just goes with the territory. It's like Steve says at the end of chapter 19, if you've got a family of four brothers or sisters that you're competing with, then you're greedy for your place in the sun. But if you're an only child, then you're anxious about being left alone. In either case, it's just the way it is. That's the hand we're dealt in life. There's no way out of it. The separation anxiety is our common lot, I guess. And probably goes back to our survival instincts, right? As a baby can't be left alone or it will die if it's not attended to. So that's a real primeval urge.
The rage he's talking about in this chapter is, you know, by the time you're 2 years old, you've done screamed, yelled, you know, and done all this crazy id stuff while you're, you know, in those 26 months. That then when you get older, then when you grow up, what's going on is, you still got that part in there. It's just subconscious to you. You don't know it's there. All the screaming and yelling and stuff you did as a child. The way I like to look at it, Philly Joe, is it's separation from a relationship with life. You know, I like to look at it like is like you was talking about. What is it all about if, you know, I grew up and everything was good and all that? Well, what is it that you're not having a relationship in with that you want to have in your heart? You know, the inner side, the ego that you don't show everybody. You show everybody your personality, but you don't show them the ego. What is it in there that you separated from? What is it in there that the TMS might be holding you back from? Then that causes rage, because you want to get out and do these things, to accomplish things in life, and the pain, whatever it might be, can hold you back. The illness or whatever it might be can hold you back, and it causes rage. That's the way I look at it, which is different than the way Freud said it, but I think that's, you know, makes sense as we're growing up. Does that make sense?
You know, could it be that in some of these families where people think things are so functional and well, and they had good childhoods and all that, may not be true. It just may be what they see on the surface, and there may be some deeper things that went on there that's not so functional and very dysfunctional, and cause some problems that they don't even know about. I know that happened in my family. My family was supposed to be the epitome of people of honesty and goodwill and normal and all this, and nothing further could have been further from the truth. It was all a damn lie from the word go, and like I said, nothing could have been further from the truth. So could some of that be what's going on here in other people too?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I sure think it's just fear of physical separation when you're a child. You know, your parents might be big hypocrites, but you, from an infant point of view, are looking for attention, your place in the sun. And the problem is that you're unconscious about all of this. It occurs in the unconscious before your sixth birthday. And you might have had an earlier trauma that occurred back then that set the stage for enormous rage later in life, and you didn't know about it.
Mm-mm. You don't know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Your parents might be morally upstanding. They might be low-down skunks. But from the point of view of a kid, his mother went away and left him alone one afternoon, and he was really hurt.
Yeah, and like me, they were lying about my identity. I didn't even know who I was. They were lying about that.
Well, that creates another prism.
But I think I may have told this story before, but at one time I was a counselor, and I had a lady come in, and she just, you know, she was just she was the most unhappy, miserable person. And when we tried to talk a little bit about her childhood, she said, she said, my childhood was wonderful. My parents were really nice. They were really busy, but there were nine of us, and we played, and we always had enough, and it was just great, right? So, I mean, I'm, scratching away here, trying to dig a little deeper and find some trauma, and there really wasn't anything significant. And then all of a sudden, it occurred to me, and I said to her, you know, it must be really hard being an adult after you had such a happy childhood. And she just burst tears and cried and cried and cried, and she said, I just want so badly to go back to where I was safe and cared for. I had brothers and sisters to play with, and I wasn't responsible for everything, and you know, so this life is trauma, but it's, you know, very, very different for different people.
Well, that's what they say about American kids, that life as teenagers is so perfect that they try and go on being eternal adolescents the rest of their life, because that was the peak, you know.
Yeah.
They could be dependent and they could be independent at the same time.
Yeah.
Great. And then we got this part in our minds that's saying, well, you should have done this and you should have done that part. It's saying, which is basically the id, and you got that going on to any occasion in your life. It could, and say you went out and you played the best soccer game you ever played, or you going to, you know, buy the groceries for a certain amount of money, but you got this part in, you know, and you didn't make it. You went overboard with a certain, and then you got this part in your mind as you're going back home to meet your husband or somebody or your wife, and you know they're going to argue with you. And before you even get there, you've been arguing with yourself the whole time. You know, does anybody got anything like that going on? This is the shoulds and the should nots, you know?
The guy that had a flat tire and he didn't have the right tools to change the tire, so he started walking towards the closest light, and he thought, oh, you know, this guy's going to be mad. I'm going to be disturbing him. It's late at night, and he probably doesn't want to lend his tools. And he talked to himself all the way to the house and knocked on the door, and the farmer opened the door and said, how can I help you? And the guy said, keep your damn tools.
Walked
away.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Okay, everybody, I like... Go ahead, Angela. Okay. Okay, I'd like to end it on this right here, that basically, the Type T's, our main goals is to make the world a better place, okay? We're excellent problem solvers. We like to avoid conflicts, you know, and we got high standards for ourselves. So we're really some great people, and we hold in a lot. It causes pain. We repress a lot. It causes pain. We've been through a lot, and we have to figure out what it is to heal. And that's what we're doing here, and that's what this whole show's about. So I'm going to end the recording on that, guys. Is everybody okay with that?
Yeah.
For me.
Sounds good.
Yep, good,
okay,
here.
All right, and then we can keep talking afterwards. That'll be it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.